opportunity to be together to look into your word, to understand you through your truth. Thank you for the privilege of having and holding your word in our hands. Thank you for the privilege to be able to understand, and thank you for the freedom we have to gather and to study and to proclaim you and your truth. Thank you for this opportunity. I pray you would encourage us. I pray that you would accomplish your purpose in what we do here this morning. We ask this in your name, amen. All right, the book of Numbers is where we find ourselves. And we're walking through the book. We've made our way to chapter 6 this morning. We spent last week talking about the test for unfaithfulness. And I've almost decided to go back there, but I'm not doing it. I'm going to push forward. So we're going to be this morning looking at, for most of our time, looking at the Nazirite vow. And then maybe get to Aaron's blessing. So if you have the notes I gave you several weeks ago, we're at under Roman numeral 1, A1B number 2. This is where we are, the Nazirite vow. This is a special vow taken by Jews. It's not for anybody else. It's for Jewish people. It's for a regular Jew who is a Jew in the land, and it is a vow that is applicable for both men and women. One of the few vows that is that way, and we see that because if you look at chapter 6, verse 2, it says, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazirite." So this is a vow that could be made by man or by woman. And it is a special vow. The term there, special vow, is really significant. It actually means an amazing vow or a wonderful vow, but it has behind it a very difficult vow. So this is an amazingly difficult vow to make because of the things they're being asked not to do. And oftentimes when we think about this vow, we think of it as, wow, the things they couldn't do. But that's really not the focus of the vow. That's not the main idea even of the text. It draws us to the separation for God. That's what's at minor. That's what's at play, is being separated to God. Making a vow in which you said, for this period of time, I'm going to be totally dedicated and totally separated and wholly consecrated to God and to Him alone. For his purpose to use in whatever he wants. And this is a vow that any Jewish person could take. It was a vow that could be made, and really it was a vow that would have grown out of a heart that desired to be wholly dedicated, wholly separated only unto God for a period of time. We have examples of Nazirite vows in the Old Testament. If I was to ask who is a Nazirite in the Old Testament, who would you say? Samson. Samson is a Nazirite. Now, it's interesting, the vow for Samson was not taken by himself. He didn't take his vow. God took the vow for him. If you look at when God appears to Samson's mom and tells her that she is going to have a child, he makes the vow for Samson. He says, first of all, he tells her, don't drink any wine or strong drink, because he will be a Nazirite. So he's protecting Samson from even the womb, And he's going to be a Nazirite not just for a period of time. He's going to be Nazirite for his entire life. He's going to be a Nazirite. So that's Samson. There's at least two more Nazirites in the Bible. Do you know who the other two Nazirites for life are? Nazirites for life. One's real close to Samson, Samuel. It appears that Samuel is a Nazirite because it's almost the language that God uses for Hannah is almost the same exact language God uses for Samson's mom. And so she's dedicating him, she's consecrating him, she's giving him wholly to God, and it's almost the same thing that God takes the Nazirite vow for Samson as well. So Samuel, I won't say that anymore, Samuel is a Nazirite. And there's one more Nazirite in an Old Testament kind of mentality, but we see him in the New Testament. John the Baptizer, or John, he wasn't really Baptist. We didn't exist back then, so he wasn't a Baptist. Amen. He's a Southern Baptist because he came from the South. No, he's not a Southern Baptist. So John, and if you see that when the angel appears to Zechariah in the temple, and he makes that thing about makes a statement about John that he won't drink wine or strong drink. He won't drink. He won't touch dead people, and he won't eat. He won't cut his hair. So those are three that we know of that took lifelong Nazirite vows. Lifelong Nazirite. They were vowed from the womb to death. They were to be Nazirites. But there are others who took Nazirite vows for a period of time. And we have, I think, examples of that even in the New Testament. Paul, I think, is an example of that in the New Testament. At the end of Acts chapter 21, Paul is heading back to Jerusalem, and he wants to get back to Jerusalem before Pentecost. If you read in Acts 21, he's made up his mind on the Feast of Unleavened Bread. He makes up his mind to go to Pentecost, and I think that he took around the Feast of Unleavened Bread time, he took a Nazirite vow, and he wants to get to he took the vow to the day of Pentecost. He wants to get to, he's trying to get down to Jerusalem, or get back to Jerusalem, so he can celebrate, he can do, he can end his vow there. We'll talk about ending the vow in a little bit. And when he goes, he heads back to Jerusalem, he goes, he meets the Ephesian elders at Miletus. He doesn't go to Ephesus because he's trying to make time and trying to get back to Jerusalem. He goes to a prophet named Agabus, and Agabus takes Paul's belt and ties around him, says, if you go back, the one who owns this belt is going to get chained up. And Paul says, I'm not afraid of that. I'll go. I'm going anyway. I'm on a mission. I need to get there. I need to get there before Pentecost. When he gets to Jerusalem, he goes to James. James the elder, the one who is the head of the Jerusalem church. And he says, what should I do? I'm here. What should I do? And James says, we have four other people here, four other men who are under the vow. And he says, take these four other men with you and go present yourself to the priest with the offering that you're supposed to take, and then have your head shaved. Have your head shaved. Why is he doing that? Well, I think that the reason that James is saying to do that is to show, because what the rumor about Paul is, that he's thrown off the law, that he's not keeping the law, that he thinks the law is insignificant, that there's no point to the law. That's the rumor about Paul. And so as he's kept this vow, as he's kept the Nazirite vow, then he goes with other guys who've kept the Nazirite vow and completes that vow, showing that he hasn't thrown off the law at all, but he's still participating in the things that the law says to do. So that's in Acts chapter 21, 24 is where James, 21, 24 is where James actually says go, 24 through 26, where James says, go and present yourself and have your head shaved. So that appears, it appears that potentially Paul took a Nazirite vow. Those are all men. There seems to be at least two women who were under a Nazirite vow for a period of time, and that those two women are Samson's mom and Hannah. Because in when God appears to them, He says, you don't take any wine or strong drink. Don't drink any wine or beer. He tells them both that. And the language that he uses there is the exact same language that's here back in Numbers chapter 6. So that's potential. That's not that there's no record of them actually taking the vow or having their head shaved after they had the kids, after they had their sons. But it appears that potentially they're under a Nazirite vow as well. You might say, well, they didn't take the vow. Well, neither did Samson, and neither did Samuel, and neither did John the Baptist. That was taken for them by God. So I think he did the same thing for the moms. So anyway, those are examples of Nazirite vow. I do think it's interesting that this vow, while significant in Israel, it, when we get to Amos chapter 2, one of the condemnations of the nation of Israel is that when their men when some had taken Nazirite vows, they were actually forcing those who had taken Nazirite vows to drink wine. They were forcing them to violate their consecration and being holy to God and taking away. It's in Amos chapter 2, just to show you how far they'd fallen. Hosea, Joel, Amos. Amos chapter 2, they're actually condemned for making those who drink, who have taken the Nazirite vow, and look at verse 12. But you made the Nazirites drink wine and commanded the prophets, saying, you shall not prophesy. So, I mean, as you get to the end of Israel, you find out that they've not only, they've thrown everything off. They've thrown everything off, and except for when you get to Amos 5, they're really having fun at the feast days, and they've stolen God's feast days, and in fact, God says, I hate your feast days. I despise them. So that's how far they've fallen. So those are some references to Nazirite vow throughout the Bible, throughout the Old Testament and New, that you can take that for free. I'm not gonna charge you for that information. So let's actually look at the Nazirite vow itself. Again, this is a vow that is a hard but amazing vow, something that was just not normal. It wasn't something that you would normal. There in Leviticus, we had provision for making vows. This is something even more significant than a regular vow that they were to make. So what is it? Well, it's this amazing vow. It says, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink, shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes fresh or dried. All the days of his separation, he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins. Now, I find it interesting that grapes, wine, that kind of was not a prohibited food item. So it's not saying, we're not being said, hey, don't eat what's prohibited. He's saying, no, you don't even get to eat something that is a valid item to eat. So this indicates a special separation, an extra separation, not just being a regular Jew who wants to keep the law and do the law. This is a secondary or greater degree of separation, because now you're not even going to eat something that is allowed to eat, something that you are able to eat. You're not going to be able to do that. So that's the first thing. And it's not just don't drink wine. Okay, it's don't drink wine or strong drink. That's the first. But then you're prohibited from anything that is produced from the grapevine. Anything that comes from the grapevine, any part of that fruit, you're prohibited from eating, from drinking, from partaking of. You can't do any of that. So that's the first thing. And I have zero idea as to why that is. Why it's grapes. Why... I don't have a clue. I mean, we do, you know, I read, you know, a lot of people guessing, a lot of people trying to guess. Because if you look, there's the grapevine, and there's don't touch anything dead provision, and grape represents blood, and blood represents life, and, well, that doesn't happen until Jesus does it at the New Covenant, when he institutes the New Covenant at the Last Supper. So that's not what this Nazirite was taking it for, because the Last Supper doesn't happen for 1,500 years. So, you know, I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's the case at all. And we could guess as to why, but that's what it would be. It would be a guess, because we don't have here telling us why grapes. He could have picked, you know, pomegranates, I guess, but he picked grapes, and I don't know why. I don't know. So... the only thing I could maybe suggest is because probably the most prolific kind of juice they could find would have been grape juice. It would have been the normal drink, and they would have been restricted to drinking water all the time instead of drinking anything with any flavor in it. I don't know. So they weren't to eat anything or drink anything that is associated with a grape. No dried grapes, no raisins, nothing like that. Okay. That's the first part of the vow. But the vow had three parts. There was three things to this vow. Second part of the vow was no razor shall touch his head until the time is completed for which he separates himself. So he was not to cut his hair, not to trim his beard, not to trim his hair, not to cut his or her hair. There was supposed to be no cutting of the hair whatsoever for the period of time that this vow was taken. So that means, for instance, for Samson, he was never supposed to cut his hair. For Samuel, he was not to cut his hair. For John the Baptist or baptizer, he was not to cut his hair. And that was to be for life. They were not to cut their hair. But other folks who took the vow for a specific period of time would not cut their hair for that period of time that they took the vow for. And then they would actually shave their head completely at the end of the time of the vow. Ron? Nothing worse than grape exchanging. Yeah, I don't think that's it at all. I'm going to walk away from that. So there was supposed to be no cutting of the hair for that period of time. This also is something that there's an indication of this kind of a thing in the law, where you're not supposed to, you know, do and shave the sideburns. But that is a very specific place where the hair was not supposed to be cut. This is the hair all over the head, not just a specific place. So this actually takes that restriction and adds to it. So in some sense, that's what the grape thing did. It took the restriction that was already there in place for dietary reasons and adds something to it to make it a bit more difficult. The hair restriction takes a restriction that was already in the law and adds to it to make it a bit more difficult. That's why I think it's referred to as the difficult vow, this special, difficult, amazing vow they were supposed to take. So they're adding something to the already existing law to make it, even on themselves, more difficult, to show an extra level of consecration and dedication to God. That's what's going on here. So that's the second thing, is no razor cutting the hair until the time of the vow is complete. At the time of the completion of the vow, they would cut their hair. In fact, they would shave their head completely. So that is the second section of the vow. The third section of the vow is this: all the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body, not even for his father or his mother or his brother or sister. If they die, he shall make himself unclean because of the separation to God is on his head. All the days of separation is holy to the Lord. So the third is not touch anything dead. Not touch anything dead. Now, that is the law for most Jews, right? If you touch something dead, you became unclean. But there was a caveat to that. If your father or mother or brother or sister died, you could be participate in preparation of that body for burial. I've just made up a new word called preparial, which means preparation for burial. So put that in the dictionary. It'll be a word in 3 weeks. Preparation for burial. They could actually touch mom, dad, brother, sister. They could do that and not become unclean. Remember, there was that caveat in the law that gave them that permission. So once again, this takes something that already exists in the law, don't touch anything dead, and adds a further restriction to it. Now you can't even touch your mother, father, brother, sister. You can't even do that. Again, this is an indication that something that's already there is getting expanded to show the significance or the special, the amazing hard part of this vow. Ron? Right, ritually. Is that me breathing here? Yeah, you're right. What Ron said was that in this situation, it seems not only could you not touch, you were not supposed to go near. That's a further restriction. And the second thing he said was in the law, you could, if you touched something, you were just ceremonially unclean until you bathed and presented yourself to the priest. This, when you touched someone dead, you were completely, the vow was completely over. Wait the period of time. Right. So there's, again, we're taking a restriction that's in the law and adding to that restriction, was what every one of the Nazirite things did. Every one of the three parts of the Nazirite took something that already existed in the law and added something to that to make this vow a more distinct vow. Now, he does give provision for an accidental touching of dead people, or touching of something dead. Look at verse 8. If any man dies very suddenly, beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day he shall shave it. There is provision made. But it does, even an accidental touching of death suspends the vow, if you will. It suspends the vow for 7 days. Where even an accidental touching, this does not take care of on purpose touching of something dead. On purpose touching of something dead is clearly prohibited and would clearly violate the vow that you have made. This is an accidental touching of something dead, or an accidental even nearness. I think that speaks to what Ron was saying, because it says if you're standing beside somebody and they have an accident, or they have a quick death, immediate death is the word I'm looking for, and they fall down dead, and you're standing beside them, your vow is now done. You have to do some stuff for that. It's at least suspended for a week. You have to go through some purification from cleansing, and then at the end of that, you go and you then have your head shaved and you restart the vow, if you will, until that period of time. It doesn't negate the vow completely, an accidental touching or an accidental nearness to something dead, but it does suspend the vow for about a week. That's how long it suspends the vow. So it's even more difficult, more special vow than regular just living as a Jew, and it would have been very difficult even to do this. So that's why it's called a hard vow, or an amazing vow, or a wonderful vow. The same word, it's interesting, the word special in the text is the same word that says this is the Lord's work and it is marvelous in our eyes. That text, when the temple is dedicated, it is marvelous in our eyes. That is the word used here for special vow. It is a marvelous vow. The word that says our God does wonders in the earth. The word God does wonders in the earth. The word wonders is the same word translated here as special. So it is a very significant vow that's being taken here. Very significant vow. But again, the vow isn't figuring new things out. It's taking laws that already exist and adding a new thing to that law to separate yourself for a period of time. We do know, like I said, of the three Nazarites who are Nazarites from the womb, that this was for their entire life. Other Nazarites, however, took it for a period of time, took the vow for a period of time, and then were done. There's an example of that in Acts chapter 21. There are four men who have taken a Nazarite vow, and they are going to go present themselves and have their heads shaved, and they're going to do what it is they need to do to get out of the Nazarite vow. So there's at least four. So it must have been something that was done. We don't have that many records, many of them recorded in Scripture of people who took that vow. We do have those who recorded that was taken for them by God, Samson, Samuel, and John. So that's the vow. Did somebody say Brian? Yes, John. It is anything dead. Which, let's just get there right now. Samson, let's talk about him. Samson is a Nazarite vow from his mother's womb, right? Samson, when Samson, was it just cutting his hair that took his strength away? No, it was not just cutting his hair that took his strength away. Samson violated all three. If you read Samson's story, you'll find out he violated all three of the things that he was supposed to do to continue to be a Nazarite. The hair was the last. The hair was the last of the three, and I think that's why the strength left. I think that's why the strength left after the three, because there's one story where he's walking about and he's hungry, right? He's hungry and he sees a dead lion, and there's honey. There's a honeycomb in the dead lion. Can't fathom this, but he does. And remember, he tells the riddle. I don't have the riddle memorized in my head, but about how he got something sweet out of the dead lion. Well, he had to have come near the dead lion to get the honey out of it, right? So he violated it there. There's another example where he actually drank wine, violated the fruit of the vine thing, and then finally he has his hair cut. So that's the third violation of the Nazirite vow. I think that's why it goes away. Chris first. Well, he did have that. That's another thing. He had the jawbone of the donkey in his hand that he killed all the Philistines with. That's what you're going to say. So I was only going to use one example of touching something dead. We could have used more because you only had to violate it once. All right, you only had to violate it once. So I took the first violation, if you will. So you only had to violate it once. So he violated all three, with the cutting of his hair being the last violation of the three. And I think that's when his strength left him, because he had violated every part of the Nazirite vow at that point. So, Dave? So he really violated the dead thing, okay? We get that. He probably really violated the grape thing, the wine thing too. I imagine Samson drank a lot of wine, so he really violated that one. He only got his hair cut once. All right, so that's probably the big deal. Anyhow, Ron said too. Much is given, much is expected, and I think that's really clear about Samson. So he's pretty much a failure until the end. Until the end of the story. So, Samson violates all three of the things, and I think that's why he loses it on the shaving of his head. So there's the accidental touching or accidental closeness of something dead. That's found in verses 9 through and following. And I think it's significant because look at how the person has to deal with. The one who's taking the Nazirite vow has to deal with the touching or being near something dead. It's much more significant than a regular person being around something dead. And this is for somebody a thing that just died right beside you, died suddenly. On the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves or two pigeons to the priest to the entrance of the tent of meeting. The priest shall offer one for a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him because he sinned by reason of the dead body. Wait a second. Hang on a minute here. I was standing here and a person died. I can't help that. But in God's economy, that still is a sin and needed to be dealt with accordingly. God says because he sinned because of the dead body. So he had to bring, that is an example of an accidental or an unintentional sin. He did not willfully approach a dead body. He was standing by the dead body when the dead, or standing by the body of live body when the dead guy falls dead, and that makes him close. And so he has to go through and offer a sin offering. He has to offer a burnt offering and have atonement made for him under the laws of the under Levitical law. He had to make that type of a sacrifice so that his sins could be atoned for because he had sinned unintentionally by being close to that dead body. And then after verse 12, after he did, then he'll consecrate his head that same day. So the vow starts over. So for 7 days, he's not in the vow anymore. For 7 days, he's going through a period of cleansing, that's the word, cleansing. And at the end of seventh day, he shaves his head. Day 8, he brings the offering to the priest. The priest makes the offering, makes atonement, and then he retakes the vow and is reconsecrated for the remainder of the period that he had set forth. So he's now back on a Nazirite vow. So there's a seven-day suspension of the vow if you get near something dead. That's the only, that's the only caveat given to any of the other violations of the Nazirite vow. There's nothing given for drinking grape juice, or nothing given for eating fruit of the vine. There's no way to get out of it, and there's nothing for the cutting of the hair. The only one that gives you get a get out of jail free card, if you will, whatever that's called. I can't think of. A way to deal with it, a pass, pass maybe. The way is being near something dead unintentionally. That's the only way. I think that's probably significant because you can't really accidentally cut your hair, right? You pretty much know that's going on. Well, Samson did, but Samson told Delilah that his strength was in his hair. He didn't know she was going to do that. Really? Really? Samson didn't know Delilah was going to do that? He'd already told her, okay, bind me with new ropes. And suddenly the next day he's bound with new ropes. You know, he told her two things, and if you do this, I won't have any strength. And he wakes up the next morning and that's done to him. What do you think is going to happen when he tells her, oh, cut my hair? Oh, she didn't mean it, right? Come on, people. So Samson knew his hair was going to get cut, I think. But drinking or eating something that's, I think you have to do that intentionally, that's intentional, getting your haircut's intentional. The only thing that could be accidental is, you know, somebody keeling over dead next to you. That could be accidental. So I think that's why you get to get out of punishment free. John Lutz. I would say that is not true. I would think they would be able to offer sacrifice. Here's why. Because in the offering of sacrifice, when the thing is not dead until after the sacrifice happens, you bring a live lamb, you don't bring a dead lamb. You bring a live pigeon, you don't bring a dead pigeon. The thing isn't dead until after it's consecrated to God. And something consecrated to God would not be something that would unconsecrate you to God. So I don't think it affects the sacrificial system whatsoever when you do the sacrificial system the way it's supposed to be done by bringing it to the priest and all that happening. So that's why I would say it does not affect the sacrifices. Ron?
Well, a couple things. Sorry.
No, you're not.
This is all original.
Yeah. So, right. What Ron said was, for those of you who couldn't hear, is this understanding, this is ritual. There's nothing about eating your grape. There's nothing about touching something dead. There's nothing about cutting your hair that made you really unclean, except for the fact that God said, don't do it. God said, don't do it. And I think that's one of the things I was trying to say is that none of this was really a... the law spoke to all of these things, but this is in addition to even what the law said. So this was all about what God had prescribed for them. And then there is an example. In Samson, there's an example of his grace, because Samson does, without being able to do any kind of penance, without being able to go to the priest, without being able to pay for what he needed to pay, without being able to do any of that, because he's in jail, God still gives him, lets his hair grow back, and still gives him the strength that he needs and asks for to accomplish the tearing down of the temple or the place that he was in. Yeah.
I was also answering the question about sacrifices. It's all ritual.
Okay. Okay, so part of the ritual sacrifice separate from the ritual. So that's the ritual part. Okay, Mike Hines. I'm not going to today now, no. Yes. So there's a difference between a dead animal, a dead body decaying in its dead state, and food that's ready to eat. There's a difference between that. They're not called, there's no call here not to eat meat. There's no call for that. There's no call, but they shouldn't be butchering the meat they eat. Okay? Also, you need to understand, We get in our head, 21st century America, that where we have meat at just about every meal, right? So we think that's normal. I would suggest that meat was very abnormal for them. It was very rare for them to have meat. Why do I say that? Well, because they didn't have a butcher shop to go to. So most of their meals consisted of grain and of vegetables. That's mostly what they ate. If you have an ox that you're going to use to plow your field, you don't want to eat that ox, right? That is not something you want to eat. You don't look at him as dinner. You look at him as labor. You look at him as a tractor. None of us go out and eat our tractors very often, right? That's what the ox was. So meat was not something that was always eaten. And a lot of times, and in fact in most cultures, meat was eaten only after a sacrifice had happened. So I think a lot of their meat came after sacrifice when they were able to go home and eat the meat. So I don't think meat was a large, but I think that the prohibition would have been, you don't butcher the meat. Most of us, and that, in fact, that's why we eat meat, is because we don't view that steak on our plate as a cow laying in a field. Right? That's why I don't eat fish, especially fish that are looking back at me. I don't eat fish looking back at me because that looks like a fish. And I don't want to eat that fish. That's a dead thing laying on my plate. I don't appreciate dead things laying on my plate. Okay, so I don't think that it would have prohibited the eating of meat, if you will. There's no prohibition. Mike? Right. So I think the idea here is an untreated dead thing. Roadkill or you know, lion kill, whatever. I think it's something untreated dead. You couldn't do that. So I think that's where we'll leave it, okay? Everything else, because there's no prohibition against eating meat here. There's none. And I think if meat would have been prohibited, he would have said, and don't eat the meat of a dead thing as well. I think that would have been added to that. So, okay? Good stuff. Let's move on if we can. I was hoping to get through all the way through chapter 6. Not going to happen. Well, let me finish. Separate himself from the Lord for the days of separation, and bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering, but the previous period shall be void because the separation was defiled. So that 7 days doesn't count. I don't know if that means add 7 days to the time that you vowed for. I'm leaning toward that. Okay, so if you vowed to do it for 3 weeks, the Nazirite vow for 3 weeks, and you took this week off, add that week back in. So now you're on it for 4 weeks. Because that time being void that you were defiled, that time doesn't count anymore. So I'm not sure what that means for sure. And I read a lot of what it might mean. But anyway, what it says is that period of time was void. So you weren't under the vow for that period of time. And I think it's interesting, you had to bring a sin offering, a burnt offering, and a guilt offering. Three separate offerings. So it was very significant that you touched or were close to this dead thing, even accidentally. Very significant. Very significant. So now we're back to verse 13 now. So this is where, how you get out of it. What happens when you're done? It says, in the law, this is the law from the Nazarite, when the time of his separation has been completed, it shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting. It shall bring a gift to the Lord, one male lamb a year old without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb a year old without blemish as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and their grain offering and their drink offerings. The priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer his sin offering, his burnt offering. He shall offer the ram as a sacrifice for the peace offering of the Lord with a basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering. Nazirite shall shave his head, shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it in the fire as another sacrifice for of the peace offering. And so there's all kinds of offerings going on. There's peace offerings, burnt offerings, grain offerings, wave offerings, heave offerings. Every kind of offering is done here, which is, so what is, why? Because it's a big deal. It's a big deal. This person, understand, this person who has come to present himself to the priest on that day has completed and fulfilled a wonderful, amazing, hard vow. And there is pomp and circumstance surrounding that. It is a big deal. There's a lamb offered. There's a ewe offered. There's a ram offered. There's a hare offering. I don't think there's the only place we see a hare offering going on, where he takes his shaved hair and puts part of it into the fire, and that gets burned up. This is a big deal, and I think it was a celebration, if you will, a celebration of the completion of this vow, because it was a difficult thing to have happen. So he goes and he does all that. The priest then waves the wave offering of the Lord, and they are a holy portion for the priest, together with the breast that is waved. And so the priest actually gets something out. And after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. After the celebration, after the sacrifices are offered, after all that is done, the vow is completed. The vow is completed, and from that point on, the Nazarite can drink wine. And I think the indication is can do all the other things that he was supposed to do. Now, can he go touch dead things? Why does it just say don't drink wine? Well, can he go touch dead things? No, that's prohibited in the law. The only dead things he's allowed to touch would be mom and dad and brother and sister. Right? So that the law hasn't gone away. The law hasn't gone away. Can he cut his hair? Well, he can cut part of his hair, but there's part of his hair he's not supposed to cut. Right? So that's why I think hair cutting isn't mentioned here. And to summarize it, he says in verse 21, this is the law of the Nazarite. But if he vows an offering to the Lord above his Nazarite vow, as he can afford, in exact accordance with the vow he takes, then he shall do it in addition to the law of Nazarite. So this is somebody who actually said, you know what, I don't want to just be a Nazarite. I want to be a super Nazarite. I don't want to just be a Nazarite. I'm going to do the Nazarite thing, but I'm also going to vow, when I'm done with this Nazarite, I'm going to give another 20,000 pigeons. Well, guess what he's supposed to do? He's supposed to bring the 20,000 pigeons. He's supposed to, if he's taken a deeper vow than that, he's supposed to honor and meet even the deeper vow that he's taken than the Nazarite vow. So that is the vow of the Nazarite. We made it. So was Jesus a Nazarite? Right? He's a Nazarene. And there's confusion over that, all right? Jesus is a Nazarene. Why is Jesus called a Nazarene? Because he thought he could lose his salvation? No, that's not. Oh, Brian, you're so funny. Why was Jesus called a Nazarene? Because he came from Nazareth, right? That's just like I'm called a Kansan because I come from Kansas. Some folks are called Iowegians because they come from Iowa. Smart plan. Get out of there. No. Right? So he's a Nazarene because he came from Nazareth. It's actually spelled different in everything. N-A-Z-A-R-E-N-E, N-A-Z-I-R-I-T-E. They do, however, come from the same root word, Nazar, right? But that's the extent of it. He's called Nazarene not because of a vow he took. He's called Nazarene because of the place where he came from. I thought he came from Bethlehem. Maybe you should get all the Bethlehem, right? Why? I thought he came from Bethlehem. No, he was born in Bethlehem. Remember? Born in Bethlehem, lived there for a couple years, went to Egypt. When he came back from Egypt, where'd he go? Nazareth. Nazareth. Yep. He said he will no longer drink this cup until he enters the kingdom, right? He did say that. Don't know what he drank. Don't know what he drank as he appeared to the disciples to show them he wasn't a ghost, but it wasn't wine. Mike? The question is, do I think the 40 days of temptation may have been a Nazarite vow? Speculation completely. I would say my first response would be no. Okay? The reason no is because he's not just abstaining from grapes. He's abstaining from all food whatsoever. He's not specifically saying I'm not going to cut my hair. He doesn't get a haircut because of he's out there in the wilderness for 40 days and there's no barbers out there, so of course he wouldn't get a haircut. And he's by himself, so there's nothing really dead for him to touch. So I don't think that it's a Nazirite vow. I don't think that at all. But that's not an uncommonly held position because of when he comes out of the water after the baptism, the Spirit descends on him as a dove, and this is my beloved Son whom I'm well pleased. And that is kind of a consecration for him. That's when it appears that his ministry starts and he becomes wholly set apart for this purpose, and he's immediately driven by the Spirit in the wilderness. I think that's where some of that understanding might come from. But I don't think, I think if this was a Nazirite vow, there would be more definition to what he's doing. So that's my opinion, strictly my opinion. You're well entitled to hold your own. If you want to be wrong all day, go ahead and do that. I got no problem with that whatsoever. Do you got any other question? I'm joking with you, actually, kind of. No, John? So Samson's, again, Samson is a Nazirite, but Samson's Nazirite vow wasn't taken by him. Samson's Nazirite vow was taken by God for him. And I think that God is adding significance to Samson's vow that it necessarily wasn't added to every Nazirite vow. What we know for a vow taken by an individual to be a Nazirite on their own accord was these three things: no grapes, no dead, and no haircut. That's what we know. Now, in Samson's deal, God says, here's what's going to happen. And again, there's actually an addition too, because most Nazirites took it for a period of time. Samson's was taken for his entire life. Dave Krim? No, we have no indication of why it is. So understand, this is something that anyone from any tribe could do. This is something that anyone from any tribe could do except Levi. Levi was already separated. The priests were already separated. But anyone could do this, could become a Nazirite. I should say that you know, I guess John the Baptist was a priest and a Nazirite as well. But anyone could do this. Anyone could do this. Why did I say John the Baptist was a priest? Seriously, John the Baptist was a priest? His dad was. So he had to be from the tribe of Levi. He had to be there. And he had to be a son of Aaron. Because if Zechariah was a priest in the temple, son of Aaron, so was John the Baptist. So John the Baptist was a priest. Dave Henseling, we're going late, but that's okay. You guys are doing it. Yeah. Right. I agree. Was to show the consecration. I agree with what Dave said there. Well, good discussion. Good job. I appreciate the talk. I thought we'd make more progress, but we didn't. So let's pray, and then I'll let you go. Lord, thank you so much for this morning. Thank you for your word. Thank you for the privilege you give us to commit ourselves, devote ourselves wholly to you. I pray you'd help us to think seriously about who we're devoting ourselves to, and that we would be willing to give you all of us. Thank you for, again, the time in your word this morning. I ask this in your name. Amen. Thanks, church. Miss. Bye.